Today is the second day of this June 2009 7-day Sesshin. We left off yesterday talking about how in our Zazen we start off by regulating the body. Really, this has to do with finding the right balance between tension and relaxation. If we were completely relaxed in our body, we'd be on the floor. We'd be like a piece of cooked spaghetti. If we were completely tense, we'd be stiff as a board. And what we search for is something between these two. Roshi Kaplow used to use the word tautness for this. It's not tense, but there is a tension in the posture. When we sit down after we've got our legs sorted out, we do this little thing of stretching up through the spine and also stretching down. There's a sense of energy going up and through the back of the head as we stretch the back of the neck a little bit gently, and also a sense of stretching down into the cushion, of being rooted, being connected to the earth. And this has a lot of energy in it, this way of holding the spine. And this is where the tautness is in our posture. When we do this, then we are creating space in our abdomen for all our internal organs to function properly, especially the lungs and the diaphragm, which are so important in terms of our breathing. Our spine provides us with the strong frame on which everything else hangs. And it's because our spine has the right amount of tension in it, the right amount of tautness, that everything else can be soft. The shoulders are soft, the face is soft, the facial mask, all the muscles of the face are relaxed, the chest can be open, and the belly round. This is very important. If you want to see a perfect example of this kind of ease coming from having this straight spine, just take a look at Manjushri next time you pass by the altar. He's sitting with this perfect poise. So it's important to understand that tension and relaxation work together. They're not two, they're not separate. They actually work together to allow us to practice. And when we've got them in the right balance, then we can sit for many, many, many hours a day. When we turn to regulating the mind, an analogous process has to occur. Just as we train the body to be stable and upright and flexible, we have to do the same with our mind. Actually, this process of regulating the mind has already started with the posture, because body and mind are not two. But just working with the posture isn't sufficient. We also have to carry on this process of balancing in the mind. And the name that's given traditionally in the Pali text to this process of regulation and balancing is shamatha. Now, I have to back up a little bit here for a moment and go into what this shamatha is and how it relates to other aspects of our practice. Essentially, in Buddhist meditation, there are always two elements. One is shamatha, which is sometimes translated as stopping or as quiescence, calming. The other element is vipassana, or insight, the deep looking that leads to awakening. In the West, we tend to stress the importance of the second of these, vipassana. And there's good reason for stressing it, because it is this insight that can liberate us from suffering. It's transformative. It's the real cure for our ills, this seeing into the nature of the mind. Maybe also we stress it because it's somehow a bit flashier than stopping. Stopping sounds kind of dull. It promises more, sexier. But to lose sight of shamatha is a huge mistake, because it is fundamental. There is no insight possible without shamatha, without the stopping. And Thich Nhat Hanh says something about this. He says, if we cannot stop, we cannot have insight. Calming allows us to rest, and resting is a precondition for healing. Meditation does not have to be hard labor. Don't struggle. Practice in a way that does not tire you out, but gives your body, emotions, and consciousness a chance to rest. Stopping, calming, and resting are preconditions for healing. If we cannot stop, the course of our destruction will just continue. The world needs healing. Individuals, communities, and nations need healing. It says here that meditation does not have to be hard labor, and that's true, but sometimes it will be. It just sometimes will take a lot of effort to stay with the practice, but we can't practice that way all the time. It'd be like trying to live your life just digging ditches constantly. You just couldn't keep it up. There are times when you have to dig ditches, but you've got to do other things too. And one of those things is to rest at times, to not be struggling every single moment. It's an important point he makes here about how, if you think of it, if you get sick, then one of the things you have to do is rest. And our human condition, you could say, is a condition of dis-ease. And so rest has to be a part of how we heal. And this is what shamatha is. So shamatha is the rest component of our healing, and vipassana, or insight, is the actual medicine, the cure. And you can extend the analogy: if you're really sick, if you just take the medicine and don't rest, it's not likely to work. And equally, with a lot of illnesses, if you just rest and don't take the medicine, you won't get better either. So they have to be working together. Perhaps one of the reasons why we tend to privilege the insight side of the coin is because of the nature of the culture we come from. We live in a culture of incessant activity, with this ethos, a sort of can-do ethos. So to stop doing may not be so attractive. We want to keep achieving and acquiring, gaining, advancing, succeeding. But the fact is that we have to develop this non-doing. We have to find a degree of calm. This is actually a prerequisite for koan work, is to have calmed and unified the mind. And we usually start off this process by working with the breath. But then when we've got some degree of calm in Zen, we usually, or very often, will graduate from the breath to koan work. And so we don't really plumb the depths of the breath work. We don't go as far as we could with it. We continue with the calming process once we move on to koan work. But the danger is that when we graduate from the breath to the koan, then we turn back and look at the breath as if it's some kind of inferior practice. And this is a big mistake. For one thing, there's no graduation in Zen. That implies that there's somewhere to go and something to get. We never graduate. We can see this in the lives of the masters. The masters all continue to do Zazen even after the deepest of awakenings. You could say they have achieved Vipassana. They have great insight. But they also must continue to maintain this other aspect, shamatha, quieting and calming. This shamatha is conditioned, and it must be maintained through a sitting. I'm going to turn now to a book called The Four Immeasurables, Cultivating a Boundless Heart by B. Allen Wallace, which has really got some extremely helpful instructions on breath practice and looking into shamatha, this quieting the mind. In this book, he says that the point of shamatha practice, which is can be done from through a number of different kinds of practice, but the one he talks about is breath practice. The point of shamatha is to make the mind serviceable. I talked in the opening ceremony about the void being empty, pure, and calm. Well, shamatha is about uncovering the empty, pure, and calm nature of the mind. Most of the time we are not acting out of this deeper aspect of our mind, but out of dysfunctional mind. Dysfunctional mind is the opposite of this. It's heavy, stiff, rigid, dark, and as Wallace says, prone to grouchiness and resistant to change. That's the mind we bring with us when we start practice. It's pretty difficult to work with, pretty unmanageable, unwieldy. Functional mind, on the other hand, is buoyant, light, stable, clear, flexible. It goes where we want it to. It stays on the topic we want it to stay on. It's ready to respond to change. Because we don't have access to this functional mind, we have to train ourselves. We have to find a way to loosen it up, smooth it out. So I want to talk a little bit about breath practice and how we can develop shamatha through it. But I think people here who are working on koans or doing shikantaza will find a lot that is also applicable to those practices. So there are really three points in shamatha practice that we need to develop, three aspects to it. And these are relaxation. Another way of thinking of this is as non-interference. Stability, which means the continuity of awareness of our practice, whatever it is. And then the third one is vividness. So not only to be aware, but to be clearly aware, to have a bright awareness of the object of our practice. And what Wallace points out, which we don't get in the instructions we receive on breath practice in Zen, is that it can be helpful to work on these three aspects in sequence. We're told in Zen, when we take up breath practice, really just become one with the breath. And we will, if we take that instruction to heart, find our way, grope our way to relaxing the mind, finding stability, developing vividness. But certainly I found these sequential instructions to be very, very helpful. And they make a lot of sense. So I'm going to read some passages from where he gives instructions, skipping around a little bit, summarizing, but hope that these are as useful to others as I found them. So first of all, he talks a little bit about this first of these three, relaxation. The first emphasis is on inducing a sense of relaxation of the body and mind, a relaxation of the awareness. This is not a forced, tensed, or directed concentration, but rather one that allows the awareness to rest in the field of tactile sensations, in the rhythm of the in-breath and the out-breath. Because of its deep habituation and many impulses, it is difficult for the mind to remain at rest for very long. Your attention is bound to be drawn away, propelled into imagination, recollection, some discursive line of thought, desire or emotion. All of these are familiar to people here, I'm sure. If you find that your mind has been carried away, see if you can release the effort that is already being exerted in carrying the mind away, especially on the out-breath. Try releasing that effort as if with a sigh of relief and release. Let go of those mental constructs and let your awareness once again come to rest in the uncontrived, unconstructed tactile sensations of the moment. The sort of very almost light bulb going on type insight he has here, I think is very helpful, is understanding that we put effort into clinging to our thoughts. It takes energy to stay with our thoughts. And to understand that that is the case, then we can see that we just have to release that effort. We have to let go of that effort of clinging to our mental processes. And the out-breath is particularly useful for this, because it is a releasing. You can feel it, feel the out-breath like opening our hand and letting whatever is in our hand fall out. It's opening our mind. There's a Soto, Japanese Soto master, who talks about opening the hand of thought. So we release our effort caught up in our thought processes and just rest, completely rest in the uncontrived, unconstructed, tactile sensations of the moment. It's a pretty good description of Shikantaza, actually, or its variations. To just rest in this moment. When working on a koan, we could think of it in terms of resting in mu, releasing everything else and resting in mu as you would in like a baby in its mother's arms. Completely safe. Completely held. For the first sessions, don't be concerned with stability, which implies continuity of attention. Don't be concerned with clarity or vividness of attention. These will come in time, but to begin with, just see if you can respond to mental agitation and distraction, not by clamping down, but by releasing the effort that is sustaining the agitation. Come back and let the awareness rest in the gentle rhythm of the in-breath and out-breath, and feel the tactile sensations throughout the body. Let your respiration be unforced and unmanipulated. Let the body breathe itself. Especially during exhalation, take the opportunity to release the effort you may be giving to distracted thought or mental wandering. Let these mental constructs blow away like autumn leaves in a breeze, and continue to relax and release right to the end of the exhalation. Continue this right into the beginning of the inhalation. Don't suck the air in, but rather relax into the in-breath. Witness it passively, as if the body is being breathed. This is a very important point, not to interfere with the breath. We come to the breath practice and we may feel we sort of have to wrestle it to the floor and pin it down. But it's quite the opposite. It's a matter of letting the breath lead the process. A problem may arise in that as soon as you focus on your breathing, it seems that you can't avoid manipulating it with your effort or will. This raises a very interesting question. Can we attend to something closely without an almost irrepressible urge to control it? Does this have any relationship to our urge to control other areas of our lives? This is not just a little problem, but a challenge that really is mainstream practice. The way you begin to crack the problem is to relax more into the exhalation. You don't have to blow it out. You just know perfectly well that exhalation will happen all by itself. When you breathe out, savor that. It feels so nice just to be effortless. Even a dying person can breathe out. We breathe perfectly in our sleep, in doing a difficult task, complicated task, when our mind is completely somewhere else, the breathing still happens. So we can put our trust in that. He says even a dying person can breathe out. Somebody completely weak, with the merest remnant of life force, can breathe out. Could probably make the claim that breathing out is the easiest thing to do. Certainly it's the last thing we ever do. But we make it difficult, we make it complicated. So breath practice is about returning to simplicity. Take a look at the way a baby breathes. It's just this beautiful, soft process. No chest movement hardly at all. It's all happening down in the belly. Then from the out-breath, just melt right into the in-breath. See if you can maintain the same sense of relaxation and release right into the in-breath. Take that surge like a surfer, riding the out-breath right into the in-breath without any paddling. The most important point is the turnaround when you just start the in-breath. It can be interesting to note very distinctly the times when you miss and suck in the breath, and compare those to the times when it just flows in. Compare a failure and a success so that you know the difference. He goes into talking about the importance of posture, which we don't need to do because we already talked about that yesterday. He says it can be helpful to make each breath a kind of adventure and an exploration so that you can just fully relax into each cycle. A full cycle would be a great accomplishment from the out-breath all the way through the in-breath. And of course, by the time you've finished the in-breath, you're ready for the next out-breath. Now you're on the downhill slope of the roller coaster, and you can easily do the next stage. See if you can just maintain that continuity. So when you have got a sense of not controlling the breath, but really just being with it, being one with it, one cycle, then the next step is to, without moving away from that ease, move towards developing more continuity from cycle to cycle, from breath to breath. He says, at this point, gross excitation, audatya, is the main problem. And I should mention that Alan Wallace is a long-time Vajrayana practitioner and teacher. But in this text, he is drawing on a Pali text from the fifth century by Buddhaghosa. Buddhaghosa was an Indian teacher who trained, did part of his training in Sri Lanka, and he's an approximate contemporary of Bodhidharma. So this is an ancient text. Very detailed. So he's talking here about when you get to the point of continuity, the main sort of obstruction to this continuity is what is called here gross excitation. Gross excitation occurs when, while trying to follow the breath, the mind disengages from the breath and attends to something else entirely. Then after this little excursion, you come to the breath perhaps seconds or even minutes later. You may attend to the breath for another second, maybe even 2 seconds, and then you're off someplace else. Gross excitation is simply lack of continuity. You've forgotten that you're meditating and you're just sitting there thinking about something. Subduing gross excitation entails staying on the object with greater continuity for longer and longer periods, 5, 10, 15 seconds and on. Notice he doesn't say 5, 10, 15 minutes here. He says, you know, we start with seconds, having real continuity. But as you move towards stability, it's important to approach it gently. This is very, very hard for many of us. We are so impatient, and we get impatient with ourselves and with the practice. And of course, this works at cross purposes to what we're trying to do. He talks about his own first retreat when he was doing this practice, and how he was so determined that he exhausted himself completely. And he just wishes that somebody had told him about how important it was to stay with that relaxation developed in the first stage when moving and making the effort to try and maintain greater continuity. If we start combining urgency with a grim-faced determination, it's likely to make us sick. Ultimately, the most important thing in practice is the continuity. But it's not at all helpful to be marking the clock thinking, can I accomplish shamatha in 1 year or 2 years or before I die or before I get old? We've got to stop watching the clock. That's what patience is all about. Just work on trying to maintain the practice continuously. Just do that. He goes on a little later to talk about once you have got a degree of stability within the relaxation of the mind that doesn't try to interfere with the breath, then once those two are in place, then it's time to apply a more concerted effort, to intensify the effort. But he says this should be a fine-tuned effort, not a gross muscular effort. Aim to sustain somewhat greater continuity without the body-mind tightening up. When you're free of gross excitation, even temporarily, there is a calm and stability in your awareness, acting like the ballast of a ship. When you have relatively good continuity, in which you simply don't lose the object for perhaps 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes, or maybe even longer at a stretch, then it's almost certain that some laxity, laya, will set in. It may feel like a complacency, a settling in. He says that in the Tibetan tradition they call it sinking, like sinking back into an easy chair and saying, well, I guess this is what I'm supposed to do, and also enjoying the comfortable nature of that place, because it is a pleasant place to be. But this is like a danger point, because we can just settle there in that kind of complacency, in that comfort of having established a degree of smoothness and ease in our practice. But it's very important at this point that we recognize that our task is not done. And in this very refined form of breath practice, shamatha, then that's when we move towards the next part, the next aspect, which is to open up the full capacity of the mind, to make the mind and the practice as bright and clear and vivid as we can. He makes an interesting comment. He says, people develop in shamatha practice at varying rates and also in various ways. Of course, with all these instructions, they never quite fit each individual's experience, their generalization. So take all this with a grain of salt. One of the dangers of this kind of sequential instruction, and perhaps one of the reasons why we don't give it so much in Zen, is that then you can start kind of keeping on checking your practice and say, which part of the sequence am I at and how am I doing? So take these instructions, but hold them lightly. Use what parts of them are helpful in any given moment and just leave the rest. So he's saying about how people practice in varying rates and different ways. So making generalizations is difficult. But he says, having said that, as a generalization, there is a strong temptation in many people to seek out vividness too soon. He says it gives you a high in the old-fashioned 60 sense of the term. There is a pleasure in it, and everything becomes extraordinarily interesting. And I think this is when we experience this vividness, it's one of the things that brings us back again and again to Sesshin. That it helps us to sit through the, you know, day one and two and three and the pain and discomfort of that, because we long to return to the vividness that comes from absorption in the practice. But he says, if the vividness lacks an underlying stability, it is fragile and tends to collapse very easily. And so, because the vividness is so enticing, it is generally sound advice to develop stability first. Likewise, it is usually helpful to emphasize relaxation before stability, because there is a common tendency, especially among Western meditators, to bring a lot of effort to the practice initially. Discipline is valuable, discipline is essential, but if you get too tense with it, then you're going to struggle a lot. But I think he makes an extremely important point here about if we move too quickly to vividness or even into insight without having developed stability. We can go to Sesshin and have these experiences and then come out of Sesshin and within a day or two feel like it's all blown away, that we're back losing our temper or getting into conflicts with people or falling into negative mind states of various kinds, and the experiences that we have in Sesshin can seem like dreams. And if this is the case, it's probably because we need to work more on the stability element of practice, of really developing quiet, calm mind. Remember, these two are so intimately related, the calm and the insight. They support each other. Earlier in this book, Wallace is talking about two kinds of practice which help to lay the groundwork for insight. One is the shamatha that we've been looking at, and the other one is the four immeasurables. This is the brahma-viharas, first of which is metta, and then karuna, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, picture. So he's talking about reasons for starting with these prior to getting into insight practice. And Zen is a kind of insight practice. He mentions various reasons. One is that if we have an insight into emptiness too early on, when our mind is not ready for it, it can just be scary. It can freak us out. And it feels like we're losing our sense of self, something very precious and valuable, if this groundwork hasn't been done properly. It's like there's not a context for that insight yet. And so it can just appear to be a frightening thing. And this is something that people can go through in Sesshin, where they may get to the sort of the brink of really entering into emptiness, and it's very frightening. And people may have to get to that brink many, many times and step back from it before they're ready to actually dive in. So the calming practice, the quiescence, is a practice which prepares the mind for entering into emptiness fearlessly, joyfully. He also talks more about this intimate connection between these two sides. He says, in practicing any meditation designed to yield radically transforming insight, whether in the Vipassana, Zen, or Tibetan Buddhist traditions, it is possible to get tantalizing glimmers that drift away elusively. This is what we were just talking about. It's like smelling something wonderful cooking in the next room. You try to track it down, but you hardly catch a little taste before it flits off, because the mind is not stable enough to enter into the insight and rest in it. Again, some groundwork is needed before we can sustain our realizations so that they are not reduced to mere episodes in memory. So many people have an experience of tremendous value, but they cannot get access to it again. A year goes by, 10 years, 20 years, it fades. It's better than if it had never happened, but if it was worthwhile at all, how much better to enter into it repeatedly, deepen it, and let it saturate your experience. Well, this is one of the reasons why we keep coming back to Sesshin, to do this, to enter into this oneness, deepen our understanding and our experience of it. If we want to enter into very deep realization and new modes of experience, we should be well equipped to do so with stability and continuity. Insofar as we can do this, the realization has the greatest possibility of saturating our experience, our beliefs, our emotions. If we can abide in such realization with continuity and clarity, it will be radically transformative. Otherwise, it's merely flirtation. if there's anyone here who doesn't sit regularly during times when they're not in session, take this to heart. If we want the insights and the experiences of session to become real and active in our everyday lives, we need to sit regularly. Otherwise, if we don't do that, then if we just come and have a good experience in session, it's not all that different from taking recreational drugs. We're not making it our own. It's just an experience, a nice experience, a flirtation, as he puts it. He says, it is possible to do a meditation retreat with great sincerity, earnestness and determination, to develop some degree of stability and vividness, and then, coming from that experience, to engage with people once again with conflict and hostility, completely blowing away everything you have accomplished. All that effort is shattered with one burst of anger, let alone the machine gun bursts of repeated anger, craving and jealousy. For better or worse, our spiritual practice takes place within the context of our life. And for better or worse, our life entails a lot more than formal spiritual practice. It entails having children, spouses, parents, jobs. The quality of our behavior can be very destructive, unraveling any progress we have made in our formal spiritual practice. The bedrock of our practice does not lie in any meditation technique. The bedrock is our lives. This is so important to understand. Just think of how many days of a year you spend in session. How many is it compared with the days that you don't? Or how many minutes or hours you spend each day in formal zazen compared with the number of hours that you don't? Our zazen, our sitting practice, is absolutely essential. But as essential is our non-zazen practice, our non-sitting practice. You know, the word zazen means sitting zen. Za means sit zen. We must practice walking zazen and hammering zazen and showering zazen and sweeping zen. In fact, we can leave the za out. Driving zen. Typing zen. The quality of how we spend our waking and even our sleeping hours needs to be a fertile ground, so that once we start to grow and mature in our practice, the roots can go deeper and the sprout can come to fruition. Really, we as practitioners, we are like gardeners. Our job is to tend to the soil, to prepare the ground. That's what we can do. We cultivate the mind. Turn everything else over to the breath, to the koan, to this moment. We'll stop here and recite the four vows.